I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Last week, police killed a sword-wielding woman after a three-hour standoff near a North Kansas City home she had allegedly broken into. The same day, police shot two men near Barney Owls Plaza for allegedly fighting over a gun. Three shootings on a single day have some wondering whether police are responding appropriately. Today, we'll get a firsthand account of the Northland shooting and discuss when law enforcement should and shouldn't shoot. Then, we say goodbye to the 14th superintendent of KCK Public Schools. Cynthia Lane is retiring after serving the district for nearly three decades. We'll discuss her long career. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas Cityans are still asking questions about three police shooting deaths last week. Two of those deaths occurred at 12th and Wyandotte Streets, where two men were reportedly fighting over a golf cart and a gun. The details around that case remain a little murky. But another shooting continues to raise questions. 28-year-old Ashley Simonetti was shot to death by police in the Northland the same day in a scene described as bizarre. It involves Simonetti running around half-naked in a bridesmaid dress and wielding a decorative Japanese sword. She was shot after bolting from a detached garage behind a burned-out home in the 3800 block of North Jackson Avenue. This came hours after police had been called to the scene. Officers had tried to reason with her and used a robot and tear gas, and none of it had worked. With us to talk about this tragedy, Grant Broughton is a neighbor and an eyewitness to all this. Grant, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Dennis Kenny is a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He joins us this morning via Skype. Dennis, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And just a quick note, we reached out to Kansas City Police and asked for a spokesperson to join us today, but the department could not make someone available to join our conversation. Grant, I'd like to begin with you and have you tell us what you saw on Thursday, because you had just put lunch on the table for your three kids when there was a knock on the door. How much information were you given about what was happening and who was at the door?
Yeah, so at that point, it was a little after one. I heard the knock on the door. I went to the door. It was one of the officers, and he just told me, hey, there's somebody in your neighbor's house. Shouldn't be in there. We think that she's wielding a sword. Just don't come outside for any reason. And then my kids came up around my back to see who was at the door, and he goes, okay, you're a father. Here's what I would suggest. Take your kids to the highest, farthest point away, because he said, I don't know what's in that house. I don't know if she can get a hold of a firearm or if she has one. We don't want it to turn into a gunfight, so get up there and get far away.
I'm wondering, Grant, when did you first catch sight of Ashley Simonetti here that afternoon?
Yeah, so she had been in the house for about an hour, hour and a half, and when she had bolted from the house, she actually ran around behind my house, not in my backyard, but around my backyard, and that was the first time I actually saw her face. I saw that she was wearing that dress that had kind of fallen off and that she had had the sword in her hand.
Did you recognize her?
I did not recognize her.
Yeah. What did you make of her behavior?
It was very erratic. It was clear to me that she was not thinking clearly. She had actually gone to the house behind me and tried to bang on the door and open that door. And she was, you could tell she was just not really thinking clearly.
Erratic, might
yeah,
be a good
very
word.
Erratic. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, she ended up holed up in the detached garage that I mentioned behind a burned out house. This is up in the 3800 block of North Jackson Avenue. I'm just wondering, were you able to follow all of her movements throughout the neighborhood?
I was actually. She ran the only part of it that I miss is when she ran around my backyard. At that point was when they fired. I don't know if it was the rubber bullets or the beanbags, but they were firing to disable her at that point. And once I heard gunshots at that point, I laid down on top of my kids on the bed just in case. And that was the only point that I missed, was her running on the other side of my house to get to that garage. As soon as that was over, then I saw, them going to the garage.
How many police officers would you estimate were on the scene?
My guess would be 15 or 20. Wow. That might be a conservative estimate, but 15 to 20, I would say.
Okay. Professor Dennis Kenny, I'd like to get your thoughts here. What do you make of what you've heard so far here in our conversation?
It sounds strange. It's obviously an unusual situation. I'm not familiar with any that are similar to it. It's a little difficult from what I've heard and what I've read to be able to reach any decisions as to police response.
You know, when you have 15 or 20 officers showing up, does that sound like the kind of response you would get in a situation like this?
That actually is good, particularly when they had a barricaded suspect. You want to be able to control the scene. That's one of the critical elements.
And by controlling the scene, that means what? Surrounding the house or the place where she has holed up?
Well, the idea is that you lock everything down so that she's unable to do any harm. And no one around can either intervene or be injured.
Okay, Grant, officers try to get her to surrender and drop the sword. They tried tear gas, they tried a robot, they tried a battering ram. Was all of that after she went into the garage where that became sort of the central focal point here?
Yeah, so they hadn't tried any of that stuff while she was in the house next door. Once she got in the garage, that's when they brought in the negotiator. They sent the robot. They did the tear gas. And before she made it to the garage was when they were firing I'm not sure if it was the rubber or the beanbags, but either way, they were trying to disable her with a shot there. So nothing really in the house.
How long did this sort of standoff inside the garage then go on? We're talking an hour or two or three or?
The garage part was about an hour to an hour and a half. I'm not 100% sure on the details there, but it was a significant amount of time.
Any theory as to why none of those different techniques worked to get her out of the garage? I mean, tear gas you think would drive her out.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if they were able to get it in there well enough. That garage is actually fairly large, so I'm not a real expert on tear gas by any means. So I'm not sure how she wasn't at some point ready to come out.
Who was talking to her, Grant, trying to get her to come out? I mean, was it one officer who took the lead, or more than one?
It was mainly one officer who took the lead. He was actually the negotiator. He was in the truck that they put the shield up. And he tried for quite some time. Hey, it's going to get really hot in there. Just come on out, drop the weapon. We want to talk with you. And was very, very just same tone the whole time. So,
yeah. And did you think he was being as effective as he possibly could be under the circumstances?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if she was going to be reasoned with. So I think, you know, what can you do at that point? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Dennis Kenny again of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. There's no doubt that police tried several different ways to get this woman to surrender. They didn't work. Shouldn't they just have waited her out with three or four officers and let the rest of the officers go home?
Well, I wouldn't have used three or four officers. First, it's not clear the less than lethal options that were deployed, how well they were deployed. Mm-hmm. Rubber bullets, bean bags, and so forth, I would have thought would well have put her down had they actually impacted her. Tear gas, as you noted, probably should have either driven her out or rendered her incapable of fleeing if it was deployed properly. I'm not entirely sure what a robot would do. The number of officers around is good to be able to, again, control the scene so that she's both unable to flee and unable to harm anyone. So it's not clear how the police handled this.
Can a person withstand tear gas, Professor? Do you know of a way that can be done that can enable someone to sort of withstand something like would have happened to this woman?
You can, not well, particularly if she had any sort of breathing apparatus, but that would be pretty unlikely. So if it was deployed well, then I would think that probably would have been sufficient.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about the use of lethal force last week in Kansas City involving an incident on Thursday that resulted in the death of 28-year-old Ashley Simonetti up in the Northland. Grant, through the several hours this took, how worried were you about your own safety, your own kids' safety as you were in your own house there?
I was worried when she was running around my backyard because at that point they were firing, and I didn't know what really was going on. I just hear shots. So when I'm laying on top of my kids, that at that point I'm going, this just got extremely personal. Mm-hmm. That was the point that I was nervous. Once she got into that house, which, you know, we've been wanting that house torn down for a long time, I'm actually, in a weird way, glad it was still there because that's where she chose to go. And that is kind of a contained environment. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, I knew it was pretty well under control.
And how were the kids doing in all this?
You know, I told them, yeah, we're going to take a nap. We're all just feeling tired today. So I told them to just lay down. And hey, if you want to get up and read a book, just make sure you just lay down. I'm going to turn the lights off. I'm just feeling kind of tired today. And, you know, they have no idea what happened.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
They have no idea. They really were oblivious to the whole
thing. Completely.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah. No, I get that. And did the neighbors know Ashley Simonetti?
It appears.
Was she known in the neighborhood?
Not that I know, not on my side. I know on the other side, it appears that she was known fairly well, but on my side, I don't think anybody knew her really.
I wonder if we can then turn to the difficult part of this conversation in the moment that the police actually shot her. She had been holed up in this garage, you said, for an hour and a half, maybe a couple of hours.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Yeah. So when they brought the handheld ram to go to the side of the garage and go in.
The handheld ram meaning to break in the side of the garage?
Right
through the wall?
No, through the door.
Through the door,
right.
Okay.
Yeah, so they went over to that side, and as soon as they kind of had made that motion, she came out of the left side, and the garage door was buckled. I can't imagine she went over the top. She probably went underneath.
Yeah,
I
saw a photograph of it last night.
Yeah, and at that point, she is running full speed ahead at them with the sword up, not like goring, not like slicing, but straight in front of her. She is full speed ahead. There's no slowing down. At that point, they are yelling, get down, get down. I mean, they over and over again, get down, get down, get down. And she kept going full force.
Right at the officers.
Right at two officers, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And that's the point when the shots rang out then.
Yeah, that is the point.
What was going through your mind at that moment? Did you think that what happened needed to happen? Were you thinking the police had overreacted? What were you thinking?
For one, it was just shock and disbelief. I knew it was in the realm of possibilities. Whenever I saw her charging directly at two officers, there's kind of a thought in your head going like, this is about to get ugly. You know what I mean? I don't think they overreacted because she is running full speed ahead directly at them. The picture's kind of been painted that she was running away from them. No, she was running directly at them.
And there's no question about that.
There's no question about that.
Yeah. Dennis Kenny, should police ever be forced to move and take action as if there's a deadline here? I mean, police were spending a lot of resources here. Does it ever make sense to think, hey, we've been here 5 hours, it's time to wrap this thing up? Or I guess what I'm driving at is, could they have gone longer here, just letting her sit in the garage?
They could have. I mean, the idea, again, is to control the scene. They've got enough resources there to be able to attempt to negotiate with her. It's not clear whether or not they actually made contact or whether they were just yelling to her. So I would say that there's some legitimate questions as to how well the scene was controlled. What the other guest just described of charging with a sword extended towards the officers would certainly suggest that at the point of the shooting decision, it was justified.
Hmm. When is deadly force justified, Dennis? What are some of the basic parameters here?
The general standard is defense of life. And so if an officer believes that either his or her life is at risk or someone else nearby is at risk, then they're justified to use deadly force.
Can that include the possibility of suicide, Dennis? If you believe the person who's being targeted might be become suicidal?
If they're threatening only themselves, then it wouldn't make much sense to use deadly force. If they're threatening someone else, then it certainly would.
Yeah. How does the fact that this woman, again, Ashley Simonetti, she appeared to be struggling with some mental health issues here throughout this early afternoon that Grant is describing to us, how does that change the math here, or does it?
It might change the math in the management of the scene. If neighbors knew her and if the police were aware of that, then there would be some additional options to be able to try to negotiate her out to control the scene. By the time they got to the shoot, don't shoot decision, her charging with a sword, her mental state really doesn't matter at that point.
What other options are you referring to?
In what sense?
Other options. You mentioned that involving a woman who was struggling with some mental health issues here. What else might have entered into the equation as officers tried to work through the situation?
Well, the ideal would be if you can contain things, and then, as I said, had they been able to identify her through negotiations with her, family members, neighbors who know her, other appeals that might have brought her down to lessen the risk that obviously wound up resulting, any of those sorts of options. The only other options they would have had at the shoot, don't shoot point would have been less than lethal, beanbags, tasers, those sorts of things. And from what was described, I think those probably would not have been recommended.
Why not?
Not likely to be, or not sufficiently likely to be effective.
Okay. How close ultimately did the officers, did Ashley come to the officers as she charged towards them, Grant?
Once they had actually shot her, she fell very close to almost to their feet. She was very, very close.
It was very close.
Yeah.
Yeah. When a person is not a realistic threat to harm anybody but herself here, Professor, does that change the calculations here?
Well, sure. If they're only threatening themselves, then deadly force really wouldn't be called for. Other alternatives. Obviously, if they committed suicide, that would be unfortunate, but there's no need for you to do it for them.
Yeah. Grant, you told the Star that you were convinced that police had acted appropriately here. I'm wondering why.
Due to the fact that she was charging directly at them with the sword, I'm not an expert on tasers or anything like that, but if somebody's coming directly at you and it's a URI situation, I believe that's what they're trained to do, is they got to do what they have to do at that point. I'm not excited about it. I don't think it's,
right.
I'm not like, woohoo, there was no winners there. It wasn't exciting by any means.
And given how close she was to them at the end, that the whole notion of using a taser or less than lethal force sounds like might not have been the best option.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, sometimes they don't take people out immediately. Sometimes, at that point, they don't know. I mean, when they came to my door, we thought she might be on meth or PCP. They weren't 100% sure if she was. They didn't know. Mm-hmm. They didn't know if she was on some sort of drugs.
I'm going to go to a phone call here. Gabrielle from Kansas City North, who was apparently the owner of the house where the sword was taken. Do I have that right, Gabrielle?
Yes.
Yeah, tell us about the sword. What can you tell us about that?
It was a decorative katana. I had bought it so long ago. I had just, it's supposed to, it has a stand, and it sits on the stand, sits on your mantle or whatever. But I had it way up in my closet. It probably was on the floor because I have a cat who climbs the closet and knocks it down. But my thing is, it looks like a katana. I know it's fake because I knew what the sword was. And I looked at the, it has two smaller swords in the set, and I looked at those afterwards, and they do have metal blades, but the edge of the blade is flat. Doesn't mean it wouldn't hurt somebody if they got hit with it. The handle is wood and plastic and cloth. But the thing is, the police didn't get to look at it that close.
I was going to say, did you have a chance to talk to the police as this incident was unfolding?
My husband did. It happened just about as he was going to leave work. I'm actually just on lunch break. I work till 5, so I was getting updates from him all day.
Okay.
But he went up there and he stayed with the police at the church nearby, and they updated him now and then.
So the police were aware of exactly what kind of instrument this thing was?
He may not have known. My husband wasn't familiar with those because...
Oh, I see. Okay.
...had it up high in my closet, and when the cat knocked it down, that we put it back up there. I mean, it's like third shelf up.
Yeah.
We had children, so we didn't want that out and about.
Yeah.
That was way up high. Okay. I forgot they existed until the cat started knocking them down.
Yeah. Gabrielle, thanks for calling. I sure appreciate it. You know, Professor, we tend to second guess police in these situations a lot. What would you tell us about that? Because obviously you weren't there, I wasn't there. I'm guessing that it's awfully easy to play armchair quarterback in cases like this.
It is. Obviously, the use of deadly force is something that we want police to do very carefully and only as a last resort. That said, they are in the position of having to make the determination of whether or not a life needs to be defended, and how well they're trained and what their options are is what's really important here. I don't know in this case what the training for the police was, but it doesn't sound as though their options once she left the shed were plentiful.
You know, the Star editorial board, the newspaper here, Professor, that I serve on, has called for an independent review of a police shooting like this. Is that standard practice? Because here, the department often conducts its own internal reviews. And I think what the editorial board was suggesting was an outside consultant coming in and looking at this. What would be the procedure that you would recommend?
I don't know that it has to be an outside consultant, but certainly I would argue that in almost all shooting cases, deadly or not, some sort of an independent review of the facts would be important to conduct. If nothing else, just to reassure the public that the investigation was fair and impartial and that the rules are being applied properly to the police.
And I'm wondering, Dennis, is it possible for a department to do its own review and still consider that to be an independent review?
It's certainly the case that departments should do their own reviews. There should, in any sort of incident like that, even down to a police pursuit, there should be after-action reviews to determine, did we handle things appropriately? You could argue, for example, that the shooting decision in this case was appropriate, but still argue that the departmental procedures leading up to it were not, and that therefore additional training and different additional procedures and those sorts of things are necessary so that you can avoid the shooting decision. The Miami police have spent a good deal of time and energy focused on the events that lead up to the shooting decision, even in the case where the shooting decision is justified.
And Professor, let me just try this one more time. So what would constitute, in your mind, an independent review? Can a department conduct a review of a case like this and still have it qualify as being something of an independent look back?
Well, I don't think it would be considered independent if the department itself did the review, which,
right,
as I said, they should do anyway.
Right, right.
Some sort of an outside body that has oversight responsibility. It could be a state police investigative unit. It could be a prosecutor. Some agencies have civilian review boards,
right,
or panels that have that capability. And you could use an outside consultant if there was reason to be concerned.
Right. You know, Grant, it's been, 5 days now since this incident. Have you had any second thoughts about your own thoughts on what occurred that day?
Not with their decision, but just with how she got to this place.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, she had been failed multiple times by the mental health system. I know her mom tried to get her a lot of help. And so, you know, I don't have 100% details on that, but I do know that she was a very troubled individual. You know, Facebook information is public, of course, and she had some very, very troubling Facebook posts that I wouldn't share the content on air.
The subjects of which were what, without going into the content, but
killing cops.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. How to make pipe bombs, things, and very graphic language about killing people, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate you coming in, Grant, and sharing your thoughts about what happened that day. I'm sure it was not a memory that you want to hang on to forever, but you may not have any choice. Yeah.
It's been pretty traumatic. The nights are kind of difficult. During the day, I'm generally fine, but you know, I'm glad it was me that saw it and not my wife. My wife just happened to be getting a haircut and I was on daddy duty. So I'm glad it was me and not her.
That's Grant Bratton, a neighbor and an eyewitness to this incident last Thursday in the Northland. Dennis Kenny, a professor from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Professor, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll visit with Cynthia Lane, the retiring superintendent of KCK Schools, following a 30-year career in the district. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we sat down with two of Representative Kevin Yoder's six Democratic challengers. We discussed gun reform, immigration, and the impact of President Trump's trade war on Kansas farmers. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. And tomorrow, we conclude that series with Yoder's Democratic challengers for Kansas's 3rd Congressional District. Hear my conversation with Brent Welder and Sylvia Williams. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, she's been a teacher, a principal, director of special education, and assistant superintendent, and for the past 8 years, the superintendent of schools in Kansas City, Kansas. But 30 years after arriving in the district, Cynthia Lane is ready to hang it up. Just 2 weeks from now, she'll be retired. Cindy Lane has been an outspoken advocate for adequate funding of Kansas schools and her district. In fact, in 2010, the KCK district became one of 4 lead school districts in the Kansas school funding lawsuit that's led to court orders calling for massive increases in spending. Cynthia Lane has been honored as a 2016 Kansas Superintendent of the Year. Last year, she was awarded the Distinguished Service Award by the Kansas School Superintendents Association. Cindy Lane's right here with me in the studio, and congratulations on a career well done.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to be with you.
How does this retirement thing feel to you now that you're 2 weeks away from walking into it?
You know, I think I'm still a little bit in denial. part of it's exciting because I can start thinking about time to just, you know, do Cindy kind of things and explore.
Yeah.
And part of it's really sad. I've had an amazing journey, worked with great people, and frankly have been touched by some amazing kids, and I'm going to miss that.
Yeah. Did you think 30 years ago that you would wind up spending your career in the same district in Kansas City, Kansas?
You know, I left KCK twice. I started as a teacher and left and was drawn back and did it one other time. And then the second time around, I stayed. And it is an amazing place. I know no other place like it.
Because it's such a melting pot? Is that what you're talking
about? It is a melting
pot.
One of the two most diverse counties in the nation, KCK and Broward County. So that's it. But it's more. It's about working alongside people who believe in the American dream and understand that what we do every day opens doors for the futures of kids. And it's just really inspiring to see kids who come from all over the world have determination and grit to overcome some obstacles that I think would bring most adults to their knees. But they keep going and persevere and frankly lead the way and tell us that they can do even more.
You know, I think there's a number for the number of languages that are spoken in the Kansas City School District. Have you guys calculated that?
About 80. And that
80.
80. And 80. That changes all the time. And kids are, and their families are truly coming from all over the world to live and grow and work in KCK. So we represent the diverse nation that I think we think about when our founding fathers created our opportunity here in this country.
And yet I get a sense there's still a challenge out there for the district, which is to sort of inform the rest of the state, the rest of the Midwest, as to exactly the challenges that you're up against. That's a tough nut to crack, but I sense that it still remains out there.
Oh, it is. You know, until you really experience the diversity, and frankly, with that diversity comes way too much poverty. It's difficult to explain why we have to be so intentional, very thoughtful about every dollar we spend, and very targeted in the work that we're doing. And I've had a board and a team that's been courageous, and they do just that. But I have to tell you, it's been the students who have shaped the work the most. They have told me and my team on a regular basis, we can do more and we want more. They want more than a high school diploma. You know, we have Diploma Plus where our kids graduate with a high school diploma and one of seven endorsements, like a year of college completed, like an industry credential. And it came from the students recognizing that to be competitive in today's economy, they needed more. So we have to be very intentional with everything that we do.
Cindy, tell us about the challenge that you face, that any district faces, but certainly at a very intense level in KCK, when it comes to working with students who I think at least at one point early on can't speak much of any English at all, and yet you're there to teach them the lessons that they have to get through.
Well, the first challenge that as an administrator we face is making sure you get the best talent in those classrooms. We need the best teachers, and we have the best teachers. And those individuals are remarkable because they lift up those differences as opportunities and craft and design lessons that can get through a language barrier, a poverty issue. It is knowing your kids and who they are and how to use what you know about them to make the learning relevant. And they do that each and every day. But it isn't easy. Many of our teachers bring food and clothing from home to make sure that a child is well fed and warm and dressed so they can focus on the learning that's in front of them.
You hear about that kind of commitment all the time.
All the time.
That teachers have to do this themselves because you're limited in terms of what you can provide them, your teachers, as well as the students who need the help.
Hence why we've been so adamant to be involved and at the forefront of what has been uncomfortable, the school finance lawsuit. We have to be there because coming from the community in Kansas that has the most diversity and kids who have the most need, when nearly 90% are free and reduced lunch, we have to ensure that our students have what they need because they may not have the means to have those gaps filled from home. So we have to do that at school. So that's why we're driven to make sure that all kids in Kansas have access to quality education.
You became superintendent in 2010, and that was the same year that the KCK district became one of the lead plaintiffs in this school funding case. Was that a hard decision for you to make at that point, or was it just clear that that's where you had to go?
It was both. It was absolutely both. The first decision that the board and I made together was, are we going to fully step into the arena of school finance? In the years up to that, we'd been supporters, but we weren't in the arena. We were on the sidelines as cheerleaders. But our kids and schools benefited the most from the successful lawsuits that came before, Montoy. And so it was a difficult decision because I knew and the board at the time knew that it would mean controversy and it would mean, creating situations where folks who didn't share our frame of mind would come to the forefront. But I remember what my grandmother always said, that time's a wasting, how grandmas can put things in perspective. And I thought about that a lot. And for our kids, time was wasting. We had to step into the arena because it means the outcome of 22,000 kids and whether or not they'll have the tools they need to live a prosperous life. So it was difficult, but at the same time, it was a decision that clearly had to be made.
How much spending per pupil was KCK getting back in 2010, and where did you feel it needed to be?
Well, in 2009, right after Montoy, 2005, we were on our way to $44,333 per student plus additional
$4,400.
Yeah, thank you, $4,400.
Yeah,
if it
right.
had been 1,000, then we wouldn't have anything to complain about.
Yeah.
But plus additional funding based on their needs, additional money for poverty, for language,
and that's been the crux of much of the issue here: the additional money that you need.
Right. We all need, no matter what your economic situation, we need a level base. So the studies said it needed to be upwards of 5,000 base per student plus the weights back in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
As the recession hit and then subsequent decisions by our legislative body and governor, we were at the 1998 levels of school funding, of just over $3,300 per student. So we're trying to do work in 2018 at levels of funding that were in the 1990s realm. It's just kind of challenging. Frankly, on one hand, it required that we ensured that we were efficient and effective with how we used our funding. But on the other hand, there were things we needed to do for our kids that we could not do because we didn't have the resources.
But you hear all the time from opponents of these big increases in school spending, Cindy, that you guys, I'm speaking about school districts writ large across the state, are wasting all kinds of money. You're inefficient. You have all kinds of money in the bank you're not spending. Come on, get with it.
Well, get with it by listening to the Taylor report that our legislators hired this past legislative session. And I almost flew out of my seat when I heard her say that Kansas has the most efficient schools in the nation. Hmm. And she marveled at how we were doing so well with resources that were well below where they needed to be. So hold us accountable for the spending, but we need to be reminded that education is what makes Kansas and the Midwest great, and that education drives our economy. So it's not just about the individual child and their family. It's about our economy, our communities, and the health of our state and nation.
Cindy Lane is my guest. She's retiring after 30 years in the Kansas City, Kansas School District, including the last eight as the superintendent of schools. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You filed that case, Cindy, in 2010, and here it is 8 years later, and the thing still ain't wrapped up. How do you feel about that?
I'm very disappointed.
Yeah.
This is Gannon 6, and was in the Supreme Court chamber for the sixth time listening to the arguments, and anticipated, probably from a hopeful lens, that we'd have an answer by this time. And nothing would have made me happier than to be able to hand the baton to the next leader saying, you now can focus full time on classroom instruction. Mm-hmm. This work is done. But it's not done. So that means that we wait for a decision, and then we continue to advocate not only for kids in KCK, but kids for across the state and what they need.
Why isn't there more recognition in Kansas about the struggles that your district is up against? What is it? I mean, is some of this politics, Cindy? I mean, you hail from maybe the most Democratic part of the state of Kansas, a state that is led by Republicans and has been for a number of years now. How much of a factor is that?
You know, I don't know it's that, because I've seen people across the party lines join forces to understand that education is important. And that particularly changed after our last election in Kansas. There wasn't such a stark divide between the parties. I do think it's coming to terms that our state's changing, that our country's changing, and frankly realizing that what we expect from K-12 is very different from when you and I were in school. I mean, I walked across the graduation stage, and the obligation of the administrators was to say, good luck to you. And then you went out, and I went out, and we figured out what we wanted to do and where we were going to go. But in today's economy, our kids can't afford to do that. They have to have a plan based on their aspirations and what's important to them and their families before they graduate from high school, and they have to have the credentials to back it up.
What kind of plan do you help those kids form?
Beginning in middle school, we do deep exploration of what are your talents, what are your aspirations, what do you think you want to do, and we start creating what we call an individual plan for with each kid and their family about how to get to where they want to go. Hmm. And that changes, it ebbs and flows, but those plans become the roadmap through high school into college if that's where they're headed, or
and they're
into
thinking
industry.
About the future, I gather, right?
They're thinking about their futures. They're thinking about what's possible. So we spend a lot of time exposing our kids to what's possible. Strong partnerships with our business community. It's not unusual for our kids to be out in business and industry starting in sixth grade, learning from the professionals, exploring what's possible, dreaming and then doing. That's what it's about.
And I gather in some households, it might be the case that thinking about the future isn't something that's emphasized a whole lot.
Many, unfortunately, of our families are struggling with today. So we grab their hands and say, let's help you with the resources you need today, while we think about what's possible for your kid's future. So it really is a partnership.
Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888 is the phone number. Cindy Lane, retiring after 30 years in the Kansas City, Kansas School District, is my guest. Chris from WICO. Chris, good morning.
Hi, I'm a lifetime resident of Kansas. I was born in Kansas, and I've lived in Wyandotte County for 30 years. and I pay outrageous property taxes. And you know what? I was always really okay with it because I believed it was going into an excellent school system. When I grew up, I could tell two things to people. One, Kansas is not flat, and we have one of the best educational systems in the nation. What our legislatures have done to our schools is unforgivable, and I don't want to pay these taxes if they're not going to put them into the school. It's that simple, and I don't think they know that. So that's all I got to say.
Chris, thank you. Cindy?
Thank you, Chris. I mean, helping our folks understand where the priority needs to be is important, so keep that voice loud and clear.
Yeah. You know, the legislature, before I walk away from the whole funding question here, has responded. I mean, they've agreed to spend $525 million more over 5 years. At least that's where things stand today. That sounds like a lot of money, but as you pointed out, this consultant that lawmakers hired this year said that number wasn't close to being large enough. What's your reaction to the $525 million, and any thoughts on what does it need to be?
It's a good start, and I applaud the effort because I know that that wasn't easy to get there. So, you know, I think what we believe is it should be $300 million a year for the next 3 years in additional money, and then on top of that, afterwards, adjustments for cost of living and inflation. So they're getting close, and their recognition that if we want world-class education in Kansas for all kids, it is expensive. It is incredibly expensive, but we can get there if we prioritize the spending, just as Chris said, prioritize the spending and we can be successful.
So during the years then, Cindy, that this lawsuit was going on, the legislature and Governor Brownback at the time were cutting taxes in a huge sort of way. What were you thinking during that time? What was going through your mind as you watched this reaction, I guess, in some ways, to the lawsuit that you were involved with?
I had the privilege of having Governor Brownback in my car as we went around to visit KCK schools. And I said to him, I understand what you're trying to do, drive economy with lower taxes, but let's have a long-range plan so that it doesn't negatively impact the very foundation of what you need, education, to boost the economy. So what was going through my mind was that we didn't have a long-range plan to truly grow the economy as we decreased taxes. What we had was suggestions of inefficient spending, and that didn't play out to be true based on the study that just came out.
Must have just driven you crazy, though.
Well, it frankly made me angry, especially when we were criticized for purchasing a piano, which was the very same piano that was purchased for schools in the surrounding suburban area. They weren't criticized, but we were. But frankly, that was the catalyst for getting our community pretty fired up that our kids deserved access to quality instruments, athletic fields, classroom materials, just as much as anyone else.
So that actually became an opportunity.
It became a huge opportunity. There were advocates that wore T-shirts with pianos on them as symbols that every child matters. And as we've gone through the lawsuit, some of my biggest memories about that experience is that as I sat and testified in district court, there were suggestions from the state attorneys that we should throw away some kids, that there are just some kids that aren't going to make it, and why are we investing in them?
Throw away some kids. Yeah. I mean, literally throw away some
literally
kids.
Literally just give up on them and move on, that they're not going to achieve. And so why are we spending money? And frankly, that goes against every grain of who I am, because I would have been one of those kids. A kid that struggled to learn to read, a kid whose mother spoke a language other than English as her first language. And so those kinds of things just emboldened us to know that we were on the side of right.
You struggled to learn how to read.
I did. Didn't learn to read till I was in seventh grade when a teacher sat with me and said, "You can do this." You know, I didn't really care about academics. I wanted to play softball. That was all I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a matter of having someone say, "You can do this," that helped me get over that hump. But for some of our kids, it's much more complicated than that, and they need ongoing resources to be successful.
And that means programs, that means money.
Programs, money, smaller class sizes, paying talent so we can have the best teachers in our classroom. It means caring about everyone's children, not just some.
How do you find the right teachers, these great teachers you draw to the KCK district?
It's a mission-driven project. I mean, if you come to KCK, you have to be all in. It has to be your heart and your mind and your dedication to work. So it's a day-to-day activity. talking with individuals, working closely with our higher ed partners, and frankly, being innovative. We reignited our Teaching Fellows program, which is an opportunity for individuals who have degrees and have been professionals in other areas to come back in and learn to be teachers. So they bring in their professional expertise. We help them with teaching pedagogy, and they can make the learning relevant. So you've got to be innovative, and you have to, you know, frankly, Kansas is 43rd in its average pay for teachers in the nation. And if we value education, we have got to turn that around.
I was going to say, do you have the luxury in Kansas City, Kansas, given that 43rd in the nation rating, to go out and get the teachers you need for your special district?
We have – the word luxury would not be in my vocabulary, but we have to take every opportunity we can to compete and recruit and show people what the work is. And so for those individuals who are in education who truly want to have an impact on individual lives, KCK is the place they want to be. Because our work is not incidental. What the children that you have in front of you every day depend on you to open the doors to their futures.
Where do your parents come from?
Our parents?
Your parents.
My parents. Mm-hmm. My mother grew up in New Bedford. She went to a Portuguese Catholic school. The family spoke Portuguese. My grandparents literally came over from Portugal. And my dad is from Kansas, and he was in the Navy, and they met, and she came to Kansas, and that's where our roots have been.
When you were struggling to read, how hard was that for you to be in fourth, fifth, sixth grade and being one of those kids who wasn't getting it?
It was horrible. So, you know, I can emotionally relate to kids who struggle in classrooms. I was in the Blackbird group, and that was not the group to be in.
The Blackbird group.
The Blackbird group.
You still remember it?
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. I remember the unkind things that were said, the limitations that were put on me because people assumed that I didn't have the capacity to learn. And many probably assume to lead. But frankly, those challenges have served me well because that little attitude that I have about don't put limitations on me and don't put them on my kids have compelled me to help my community and my team and my kids do things that other people wouldn't dare to do, like, say, raise our standards, like promise that you're going to graduate with more than your high school diploma, like saying to the community and the business world, come in, we need your help. Like passing a $235 million bond referendum that we just passed to improve every school in our community. Bold and courageous moves that come from that undying attitude to do whatever it takes to help people succeed.
Let's go to some phone calls here quickly. Robert from Kansas City, Kansas. You're on with Cindy Lane. Robert, good morning.
Hello. I'm just going to jump right into it. But, like, you know, children are the future. Obviously, you know, I have a 7-year-old in elementary school right now. And it's just, you know, you talk about getting return on your investment. You know, you kind of get what you pay for. If you, you know, like she said, the superintendent said, like, $330 million per year. And they're only talking about $500 million over a 5-year period. So, you know, obviously you want to invest a lot so that you can get a return back. You know, not all of the great speakers and whatnot come from, you know, good schools and whatnot. You know, there's plenty of people who are very talented that come from low-income areas.
I think we have to leave it right there, and that's what you've been speaking about.
That's right.
Well, Cindy Lane, congratulations on a terrific career. Thanks for coming in today, and we wish you the best of luck in retirement.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Cindy Lane, retiring after 30 years in the Kansas City, Kansas School District. Tomorrow on the show, the host of the sports storytelling program, Only a Game, is retiring too. We'll chat with a longtime host, Bill Littlefield, about 25 years as the voice of NPR's Only Sports Show. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.